From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. In the best 70s tradition, we are still at lunch this week. Part 2 of our date with Derek Bell. Let's find out what happened after the end of his Formula One career. Things went well in his endurance racing. He was free to devote his time to long distance racing. He was a Liberty Bell, you might say. Anyway, so let's have another bottle of Perrier water, Derek, and crack on this week at 30 laps. His driving was described as so sparkling, people used to say he walked on Perrier water. And this week we do go home from the lunch and the limo from last week, I promise. Take me back to the hotel, Jeeves. Let's see what these limos are all about. The big ones, the fast ones, and the huge ones. This week, in 30 laps. So we left Derek at the end of his Formula One career, turning his attention to something else. His sports car career blossomed. New rules outlawed the big 917 for 1972, but Derek stayed with JW, driving the Mirage M6 and its successors, and finishing fourth at Le Mans in 1974 with Mike Hailwood. In 75, his golf contract only tied him to Le Mans, so he did the rest of the season with Alfa Romeo. In the T33 TT12, winning at Spa, Watkins Glen and Zeltvig. With his old F3 rival Pizzicarolo, the cars were run by Willy Clausen, but the substantial figure of Alfa's legendary racing boss, Carlo Cittiti, was at every race. Whatever the weather, he'd always wear his three-piece suit. He'd sit in the pits on a hot day in his shirt sleeves and braces, his trousers pulled up over his big gut, snuffing panini into his face. I should say stuffing panini into his face, with a handkerchief on his head to keep off the sun, tied with a knot in each corner. He was a wonderful character. That season's single golf race brought him his first Le Mans victory with Jackie X. Jackie wrote to Wire asking him to join the team for Le Mans and suggesting he was paired with me, which was nice. It was a nerve-wracking race because of the last 6 hours the car was clattering and graunching in the back. In the pits they could only find insequential damage, or nothing wrong at all, in fact. But a rear suspension bracket had broken. We just held on to win. From the French Ligier, it was a hugely emotional moment to be on the podium. By then I understood how important Le Mans was. In 1977-78, Derek did Le Mans for Renault, a great young team, so enthusiastic. In 77, Jabouille and I led for 17 hours, but then the engine let go. Same thing in 78, with our teammates Didier Pironi and Jean-Pierre Jussard. They won. His relationship with Porsche was renewed with a 924 at Le Mans in 1980. And for 81, he was back with X for a copybook run in the Porsche 936 to score win number two. In 1982, the new 956 had arrived, and with it came win number three. It could easily have been three in a row in 1983, but this time things didn't run to plan. X was taken off on lap two by Jan Lammers, private Porsche 956, but he and Derek worked back up the field to lead by 6 a.m. in the morning. Then the disc brakes started cracking. More time was lost, but despite inadequate and unpredictable braking, Derek staged a brilliant late charge back to second place, failing to catch the teammates by barely a minute. Jackie X and I developed a special relationship. Some people said he was a prima donna, but we always got on very well. People think of him as a great sports car driver, but of course he was a brilliant F1 driver as well, runner-up in the World Championship two consecutive years. The reason I liked driving with Jackie was that he was always lucky, always had this amazing good fortune. All the engineers and mechanics loved him, and because they knew he was the best, they gave him the best equipment. It was a combined best effort. If you were with him, you got the best too. I always wanted to be with somebody who was as good as me, if not a little better. Jackie was outstandingly professional, brilliant in the wet, and always pushed the car really hard. Yet he had mechanical sympathy as well. John Wire always used to say, to be a good long-distance racer, you have to have mechanical sympathy. You have to treat the car properly. Nowadays, there's no worries about wheel spin or over-revving or missed gear changes, and they have power steering and even air conditioning, and the cars are more reliable anyway. But you still have to be able to be extremely quick without taking risks, without having accidents. I never had an accident in a works Porsche. I spun a few times, but I never lost a position through driver error. In fact, in my entire sports car career, I only once went off the road. That was at Le Mans, at Radu, and I went out with brand new tyres. Forgot they weren't, scrubbed in and slid off at the first chicane. But I got myself out and carried on. For me, the three greatest long-distance drivers I've ever known were Ix, Hans Stuck and Al Albert. Stucky came in when Ix retired, and actually he was even faster than Jackie, as fast as Stefan Bellof, in my view. He's a vivacious, carefree Austrian lunatic, and he always threw the car around with gay abandon. He never seemed to damage it. He was far more exciting to watch than anyone else in the rain, and when he got to pole position, he'd come down the pit lane screeching and waving and yodeling with delight. But he never put a foot wrong and was incredibly quick. Al Holbert couldn't have been a more different person. Quiet, contained, deeply religious, very well organised, but also brilliantly fast. He was a superb engineer and a wonderful guy. Head of a dealership, head of a racing team, and they ran an Indy operation. In September 1988, we were all in Ohio for the IMSA street race in Columbus. After Friday practice, he decided to fly home to take his son to a football match. His Aerostar crashed on takeoff because of a door had come open suddenly. He was only 41. It was a real tragedy. Stefan Bellof, well, he was the fastest, wildest man I ever drove with. I always thought he would settle down, and that when he drove for Tyrrell, Ken would be able to help him mature. For the 1983 Nürburgring 1000, he put our car on pole in a lap of 6 minutes 11 seconds, the first time anyone had averaged 200 kilometres an hour around the ring. In the race, I handed the car over to him in the lead, and he started to go quicker and quicker. In the pits, I said to Professor Bott, "Don't you think it might be a good idea for him to slow down a bit?" Then we learned he had a massive crash at Pflanzergarten. John Wire couldn't have stood for something like that. It was a completely unnecessary accident. But then Stefan got back to the pits, unhurt. He laughed it off. When he had his fatal accident at Spa, he was driving for Brunn, and he tried to pass Jackie Ix's works car for the lead at Eau Roger. Jackie was completely blameless. He was staying online and giving Stefan plenty of room, coming down Le Soiree, but at Frau Rouge, it just wasn't on. The Porsche 956 was replaced by the 962 with more cockpit length to comply with new rules to get the driver's feet behind the axle line. When I'm asked what my favourite car was, I have to say it was the 962. In Europe and America, I must have won over 30 races with it, and after a bit, you stopped realising just how good it was. Just got on it, you just got in it, and you drove, and you won. It was brilliant. Add together the 956 and the 962, and I just don't know how many races I won. About 37, I suppose. Of course, I loved the 917 because it had around 600 horsepower. Today's cars have that and more, but they've got so much more grip. When you put your foot down in the 917, you had huge wheel spin, clouds of rubber smoke, and you'd be soaring away at the wheel, always lots of drama. And the rain, you'd be going down the Mulsanne Strait with armfuls of lock on. That doesn't happen today in today's cars, sadly. Derek has done Le Mans 26 times in all. His last two victories came in 86 and 87, both times with Stuck and Hulbert, forcing the pace to break the Jaguar XJRs. One race he won't forget in a hurry was 1995. The previous year, after finishing sixth in a Crema Porsche, he'd done his last Le Mans. Yet the following year he was tempted back, at 3 weeks' notice, to drive a McLaren GTR with his son Justin and Andy Wallace, the Harrods-sponsored car run by Dave Price Racing. The weather was dreadful. Le Mans veterans said it was the worst in the history of the race. But Bell loved the 956, and he and Vern Schuppen were second at Spa in 1982. Unless you've driven Le Mans at night in heavy rain, you've no concept of what it's like. The Mulsanne Strait is a piece of cake, as long as you don't aquaplane, and the chicanes are well illuminated. But you come out at Agenage, second gear, third, fourth, fifth, over the brow, and up into Porsche curves, at 165 miles an hour. You can't see in the dark where the track ends and the grass begins. That's the worst place. But you just have to keep the power on. That year, we'd got the car into the lead, and I'd hand it over to Justin at about 11:30 at night, pitch black, rain coming down, and I hadn't been in the motorhome long when Justin walked in. "What are you doing here?" I asked him. His eyes were big and round. He said, "Dad, I've never been so frightened in all my life." Dave Price, to give him his due, saw that Justin had scared himself and hauled him out. Put Andy Wallace in. Justin felt terrible about it, but he didn't have the experience that Andy and I had. I told him if he'd crashed, it would have been the team's fault. During the night, I did 2.5 hours out there in the rain, and by 4 a.m. we were back in the lead. I got out, exhausted. Andy took over, and after an hour, he was back in again. It said he'd had it. He couldn't concentrate, so I took over again. I drove a lot of hours in that race. I was 53 years old, and I was knackered. During the morning, it dried out, but JJ Leto and the long tail car couldn't get a tenth of a second off me. It really looked like we were going to win. But with 2.5 hours to go, I started having problems selecting gears. I had to chug out of the pits in top gear and leave it there. The lead was gone, and with it, the chances of Derek's sixth Le Mans. Although he, Justin and Andy did bring the car home third. Derek has won Daytona 24 Hours 3 times. He believes it's the most challenging, and even more challenging at times than Le Mans. The great thing about Le Mans is the Mulsanne Strait, which, even with the chicanes now, does give you a chance to relax your muscles and move your shoulders around. Daytona has nothing. The G-loads on the banking are punishing, and on the infield you have a sequence of very tight corners, usually crowded with cars of widely different performance. In 1990, I had the biggest crash of my career in a 962. We just refuelled, and I was high on the banking, about 6 feet from the wall, when a tyre burst. The car hit the wall, went up in the air, and flew a long, long way. And then it came down, and carried on upside down. The top of my helmet was scraping away by the track surface. Finally it stopped, and I could smell petrol, so I switched off and pushed the fire extinguisher button. By the time they got me out, I'd passed out from the halon gas, because halon works by taking the oxygen out of the air.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow. when your rooster crows at the break of dawn. Look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm a-traveling on. But don't think twice, it's all right.
He was okay. He didn't have to think twice. So many other stories, like the Broadspeed Jaguar XJC12, which Derek and Andy Rouse brought home to second place at the Nürburgring. By far that ill-fated car's best result. Problems and arguments within the Porsche team developed the PDK transmission and ABS braking. Formula 5000 in the US and Australia, and the Hexagon Penske Formula One car in British events. Helping out with a three-year Bentley Speed 8 program at Le Mans, which resulted in victory in 2003. Racing Alpine BMW CSLs, Kremer and Lewes 935s, and the ROOC Camaros. For more than 40 years, Derek Bell has earned his daily bread by campaigning an extraordinary variety of cars, and always he has believed that his first duty in any race, is towards his team. To be a successful endurance driver, you have to temper your personal ambitions with the requirements of the team. That's how it works, and you must accept that from the first. Had Derek's cards fallen differently, he might have been a great Formula One driver and had a great career. But his natural ability to work with people under pressure, teammates, team bosses, engineers, mechanics, and then to display all that and more and get speed that maybe not the egotism or arrogance of some of his contemporaries have helped him become, quite simply, the most successful Briton ever in long distance racing. And it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. And that, folks, was part two of Lunch with Derek Bell. We started part one last week. It comes from Motorsport Magazine from the September 2009 edition. And it was written by Simon Taylor. And it's a great story of a great driver. So I think it was worth spending the time, hey? I think if you were in trouble, or your car was in trouble, or your team was in trouble, you'd call on Derek. He'd give you shelter from the storm.
Was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And now let's hit the limos and go home from our lunch. What's a limousine? Why is it called a limousine? The word limousine is derived from the French region of limousine, a particular type of carriage hood or roof physically resembled the raised hood of the cloak worn by the shepherds there. The name was then extended to this particular type of car with a permanent top protecting over the chauffeur. There you go. This is the greatest limousines ever made, or some of them, the US edition, so forgive us for that. Auto Car Magazine in August 2020 by Al Sutty. Limousines come in all shapes, and they're all big when talking about size. The focus is very much on those in the back seat, where comfort, space and luxury are what counts more than driver satisfaction. That's not to say every limo is a barge on wheels, and several have become regular offerings alongside the rest of the car maker's range. There are very few off-the-peg limos now, and most are bespoke builds by specialist coachmakers, which is apt when the roots of the limousine lie in horse-drawn carriages. Yet there are still a few for those who want the ultimate in legroom and opulence. We've corralled the best of the stretch and give you the best limos in order of date. The Cadillac 75. The 75 has a history of being Cadillac's flagship going back to 1936. Its extra length was devoted to rear seat passengers, and it can accommodate up to 8, thanks to a fold-up occasional rear seat and 3 abreast on the front bench. All of this came at a standard package straight off the line, and it reached its zenith in the 1959 model year with fins and chrome to match the 75's size. Time was called on the 75 when the 1987 Fleetwood came to an end. We know about the Fleetwood on 30 laps. We did a show on that car last year. Although the writing's been on the wall ever since the mammoth 7-litre 425 cubic inch V8 had given way to a mere 4.1 litre 249 cubic inch motor. Since then, Cadillac has not built a limousine as part of its over-the-counter range, but you can still pick up a 75 from around $11,000 US for a clean, line, handsome 1960s version. The Rolls-Royce Phantom 1959. For such a car of elegant proportions and obvious royal connections, the Rolls-Royce Phantom 5 can be hard, or had, for surprisingly, bad writing here, surprisingly modest terms. Have a look around the classifieds and you can find them for just under $90,000 in the United States, which bags you a huge amount of stately limousine for the money. No two will be the same, even though Rolls-Royce offered a standard package of bodies from coach builders such as H.J. Mulliner James. In total, 516 Phantom 5s were supplied, with several making it their way to the royal family and other heads of state around the world. However, Beatle John Lennon caused an uproar when he had his Phantom painted in psychedelic colours by artist Steve Weaver. Though the design was really inspired by Romany gypsy patterns, Lennon also had a double bed installed in his car. Though most Phantom 5s have a more formal bench and tip-up occasional seats to carry as many as 6 passengers. Mercedes-Benz 600 Pullman 1963. Mercedes was the only company to truly rival the imperious pomp of Rolls-Royce Phantom 5 when it was launched. The 600 in 1963. Nicknamed the Grosser, meaning grand, it dwarfed most cars of the period, even in the standard 215-inch length. Choose the Pullman and the stretched out to 246 to accommodate a pair of rear-facing seats. You could also pick up a 6-door model if you wanted to avoid passengers clambering to get in to their chairs. Power for all 2,677 600s, including 428 Pullmans, came from the much-vaunted M100 V8. This 6.3-litre motor used fuel injection to deliver 250 brake horsepower to whisk the Pullman up to 125 mile an hour, and also to provide the energy for the 600's many hydraulic systems used to power everything from the brakes and windows to the door locks. Today, you'll shell out anything from $40,000 for a standard wheelbase and more like $500,000 for an immaculate Pullman. There's a high risk, however, that if you buy one of the latter, your friends may conclude you are suffering from a severe bout of megalomania. Ah, the Zill 4104 from 1973. No 1980s Cold War film would be complete without a Zill 2104 sloping into view in all its menacing girth. Built purely for the leaders of the Soviet Union, only 106 were ever made. So you knew to get out of the way of one of these 7,495-pound, 250-inch Leviathans if they came into view. Yet despite their size, weight and imposing looks, the Zill was quite sparsely appointed. Leather upholstery with an electric seat adjustment, air conditioning and a cassette player were about it. It says more about the people inside the car that the 4104s also came with bullet and radiation proof glass. They also had a huge 32 US gallon fuel tank to cope with the 7.7 litre V8's thirst. You can track it down a Zill 4104 today, expect to pay around $300,000 US, though they often make nearer a cool million in their homeland. The Maybach. The name has been synonymous with luxury cars since 1909, and since 1960 it's been part of the Mercedes-Benz family. For the 2002 Maybach 62 launch, they put it on the Queen Elizabeth II to conjure up the right atmosphere of luxury and relaxed cruising. There was guaranteed thanks to a 243-inch overall length and seating deliberately limited to just two seats in the back. Crikey. There was very much a car for the super rich rather than the private hire trade. Performance was also aimed at those who regard time as money, as the 62 could waft from 60 to 62 miles an hour in 5.2 seconds. Thanks to a twin turbo 5.5 litre V12 producing 613 horsepower. Even so, the 62 was a slow seller and the shorter wheelbase 57 did little to retrieve the situation in the face of the global recession. Production halted for these Maybach models in 2012, with around 3,000 being sold. And we'll end this with the presidential state car, 2018. President Trump might not see eye to eye with his predecessor, but he's reaping the rewards of two cars that were first ordered in 2013 by Barack Obama in the Obama administration at a cost of $16 million. Known as the Beast, this behemoth weighs in at 20,000 pounds and certainly looked like a Cadillac, wears both its badge and its company's latest design language. But it's based on a modified Chevrolet Suburban truck chassis to deal with the weight caused by so much armour and survival equipment. Among that equipment is fire suppressant system, an air supply, run flat tyres, bulletproof and bombproof glass. The new car's first put in an operational appearance in September 2018. Despite its size and weight, part of the brief to Cadillac when the latest Beast was commissioned was that it had to be nimble. That includes being able to perform high-speed direction change J-turns should the driver need to extradite the president from an ambush or a roadblock. Details on the rest of the specifications are kept secret, and the current practice is to destroy retiring limousines lest the secrets be revealed. Two beasts always deploy at the same time with identical license plates. That way, any possible assailant can never be quite sure which car the mop top is in. This decoy practice is also used when the president travels by helicopter. So that's us for this week with the Beast and the President and the helicopter. Two of, please. Well, certainly no, not two of Trump. I can't cope with one. I hope you enjoyed Derek Bell's lunch. And I picked up the bill, so you don't need to worry about that. All good. And a little story about the limousines. We haven't finished with that. There's a few more that we need to cover. And cover them we will, sometime in the near future, in 30 laps. Thanks for your company. It's been great bringing you the show, as usual. I look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye for now.